Are you cyber confident? Do you know what your digital footprint is? Do you understand the reasons you're a cyber target? In this podcast series, you'll learn what it means to be cyber confident both at work and at home. Because when it comes to cyber security, the front line is you. I'm Josella Waldron, and in this episode, you'll hear from James Waller, who's head of people and physical security at the Cabinet Office. James has a fascinating story about one of the government's biggest ever secrets. First of all, though, I asked him to explain what the Cabinet Office does.
So the Cabinet Office is a department at the very heart of Whitehall. We have a range of departments in government. We have, for example, the Home Office, the Ministry of Defence, and various other departments that are responsible for different parts of government policy. The role of the Cabinet Office is to sit at the very heart of government, supporting Number 10 in looking across all the various different policies that are being enacted and bringing together different strands of work to make sure that government and the civil service as a whole is doing what the politicians would like the civil service to do. So it's a really important sort of central part of government. As an organisation, the Cabinet Office works to handle a variety of different constitutional issues. We look at secretariat issues, so they chair the Cabinet meetings, for example, and we're also responsible for strengthening the Union of the United Kingdom. One of the most important roles that the Cabinet Office has historically played, though, is coordinating the security of the realm, and that is about making sure that the country as a whole is safe and that arrangements are in place to ensure that government can continue and we can continue to make sure the country is properly supported. This is historically been a very, very important role for the Cabinet Office. And during the Cold War, for example, we were actually the lead department for planning what we sometimes call the machinery of government in war and looking at all the different ways that the British government would actually plan to survive a nuclear war and keep the state functioning, and how we would ensure that even in the most disastrous circumstances imaginable, there would still be some form of government in existence.
So what do you do in the Cabinet Office security team?
So I'm the head of the people and physical security team. I lead an absolutely fantastic team of people, and our role is to look at all of the different areas around where there might be a risk to the security of the Cabinet Office. I'm looking after the security of our vetting and how we keep our people safe. I look after the physical security of our sites to make sure that they are physically safe from compromise and that everything is okay with them. And we also look after protecting of our information, because as I'm sure you can imagine, we look after a lot of incredibly sensitive and often very classified information. And when you put all that together, my team is responsible for ensuring the safety of the people, places and information that is so central to the delivery of good government today.
So the focus is on survival of the government. Can you tell us any more about this?
Yeah, so in the Cold War, the British government worked out very quickly after 1945 that there was likely to be a risk of conflict again, this time with the Soviet Union. We'd survived World War II. There were lots of various bunkers built under London. The Cabinet War Rooms to this day is a very popular tourist attraction. And there was a real discussion about, well, how do you survive a nuclear attack? In the late 1940s and early 1950s, a lot of the thinking was paradoxically that actually you could survive a nuclear attack in London. There wouldn't be many atomic bombs dropped. They don't think the Russians had that many available to them. And based on the experiences of the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it was realised that actually you could survive and start to rebuild fairly quickly. This sounds almost paradoxical, but there was an element that the damage done would have been overcome in some way. So in the late 1940s and early 1950s, the government built various different bunkers under Whitehall, different tunnel networks, and planned to have about 40,000 civil servants sitting around various shelters in London, waiting for the bomb to drop and then carry on. In the mid-1950s, though, it was realised that actually the things changed significantly. The world had moved from what we called the atomic bomb to the hydrogen bomb, which is vastly more destructive. And it was realised that actually the UK government wouldn't survive sitting underground in Whitehall in the event of a bomb being dropped, and it had to go somewhere else. To that end, the Cabinet Office led the work to create a site where you could move the British government in its entirety all the different functions of state that were carried out to somewhere in complete secrecy and rebuild Whitehall. So over about 10 years from the early 1950s through to the late 1950s, a old World War II factory in Corsham in the West Country, which was located deep underground in a quarry, was converted into an enormous nuclear bunker. Now, this site was designed to house about 4,000 people who would have been moved at very short notice from central London out to the West Country. The idea was that you would have this facility, it would sit in total secrecy, very few people would know anything about it, and it wouldn't even have an official name. It would have a code word to call it a name. So over the years, it's been called Stockwell, Subterfuge, Burlington as its most popular name, to refer to it at different stages in its life. The idea was essentially that in the event of nuclear war looming, World War III had started, nuclear war would loom, the British government had various plans in place that people from different departments would effectively get together. They would be told at very short notice, maybe 24 hours notice, that they had to move to this headquarters, that they didn't know where it was, and they would be moved by a series of convoys to a location that was called the checkpoint. It's actually quite horrifying when you think about it, that you'd have all these civil servants coping with the idea that World War III was on the verge of breaking out, suddenly being given a letter in Whitehall telling them that they had to leave their families, leave their loved one behind because there was no room for any families or children to come with these people. They would be told to bring a suitcase, to sit in well-known government buildings. So if you worked in the MOD, you'd sit in the pillared hall and you'd be collected, put into a bus and driven to a station. You would take a train to Warminster and then you'd be put in the back of an army lorry and driven up to Corsham and into the bunker. And you'd probably never see your family again. I can only imagine the trauma that must have caused so many people if they knew that was going to happen. And all of this was done in complete secrecy. Not one really of the 4,000 civil servants nominated had the slightest clue that in the event of World War III breaking out, they'd have to leave their families behind. What was resulting was they would have gone to a facility that was absolutely enormous. There is a lot of information now about the Corsham bunker online, but it has quite literally hundreds of rooms below ground. It has an operating theatre and a hospital wing. It has a gigantic phone exchange. It has its own power stations and all manner of offices, and all the way up to some very plush VIP accommodation that was probably going to look after members of the royal family in a crisis. It would have quite literally been an underground Whitehall, which people would have been in for about 4 weeks, waiting out, watching what had happened with these nuclear war going on, and then trying to work out how to put the country back together. And hopefully, in the timescale envisioned, it would have been the heart of the British government's reconstruction effort.
So how on earth did they manage to keep it a secret?
It's something that was a real problem for my predecessors in the security teams working with our colleagues in the Cabinet Office, because obviously my predecessors looked after this. It was built through a series of code words. So in government, rather than talk about the site, if you said Corsham, we're going to Corsham, you've told the whole world where you're going. And obviously if the Russians know where you're going, then they can stick a nuclear warhead and target it and blow the bunker up. So instead it had lots of code words, so it was referred to differently. So as I say, it was called Burlington, Stockwell, Turnstile, and they changed the code words regularly. As people moved on or breaches happened, they could change the meaning of the site. They also compartmented it. So in government, they really applied what we call the need to know principle. So they took this very sensitive information and you were only told about it if you very genuinely needed to know. Because they worked on the assumption that the less you knew, the harder it was to compromise the whole picture. So the whole plans, the totality of what we call the transition to war planning and the war book and all the plans associated with this, probably less than 100 people knew the totality of the plans in government at any one time. Yet they were making plans that would attract tens of thousands of people moving around the country to different facilities, different bunkers and different work in different ways. So it was all incredibly tightly held. Now, there's pros and cons to this, because obviously the more that you conceal the information, the more you protect it, the safer the secret is, because less people can know it and it's much harder to compromise. But it also meant you could never practice it. So during the Cold War, they never tried going to the site. They never tried staffing it, and they never tried testing the plans they'd drawn up. So we have no idea if it would have worked or not. There's lots of incredible plans in the National Archives that you can download and read, talking about how, you know, in the event of war, you'd have moved to a very precise timetable. We just don't know if it would have worked because the secret, it was so secret, we'd have been doing it for the first time on the day of the races, and that would have been really difficult. So they tried to keep the secret in a very effective way, and the challenge was obviously keeping the secret meant actually making the site work probably wouldn't have worked in itself.
So what would the implications have been if the information had been lost?
So if, for example, the existence of Corsham had leaked out, if it had been known that in the event of war, the Prime Minister would have flown by helicopter to this site or the War Cabinet would have gone there, then the likelihood is that the Russians would have used that information to target the site. They would have put a nuclear missile or two on it, and in the event of war, they'd have fired at it and destroyed the site. This would have wiped out the whole of the British government in one fell swoop. Although there were lots of other sort of facilities around the country for local government and regional government, this was the one site where there was definitely going to be a central government presence, which means that if you didn't protect it, in the event of war, you'd have lost the whole of the government in one go. All the key decision makers, all the people who knew each other, all the communications links, completely wiped out. And that would have meant in the rebuilding and the aftermath, it would have been even more difficult to do. So protecting this site was absolutely critical, and it's one of the most important things that the Cabinet Office had to guard during the Cold War, was the implications of this site and what would have happened if it had been compromised. And it remained top secret for many decades as a result.
So did anyone have any hints that this was there? Did it get leaked at all?
Yes. This is the problem. It's really hard in government to keep secrets sometimes. I think anybody who reads the papers realises every day that there are secrets that leak out or information that leaks out. And in the 1950s and early 1960s, there was a journalist called Chapman Pincher, who was a very famous journalist, who was given a bit of a nudge to make him aware of this site and wider retaliation plans. Now, it's never really been determined if he was intentionally told it or if he was told by a minister or if he found out by accident. And we never really got to the bottom of how Chapman Pincher found this out. But by the late 1950s, it became very clear that the site had been compromised in some way. We think that the Russians knew where it was. It's not that hard to spot roughly where there's quarries in the West Country. And over the next few years, there were whispers and rumours going out. So by the 1960s and the 1970s, there are books out there, books like Beneath the City Streets or the book War Plan UK, published in the 1980s. They talk about this site and they talk about what may or may not have gone on there. But this is where it gets really interesting, though, because although people assumed they knew where it was, there was actually a plan within a plan. And this is perhaps one of the best parts of deception the British government's ever done. It was recognised by the early 1960s that the site was probably known about. We realised during Cuba and the Berlin crisis of the early 1960s that actually it'd be very difficult to staff in a hurry, and a gigantic bunker full of thousands of people would have been very recognisable. So instead, a brand new plan was devised to say, if we know that the Russians know where we are, and if we know that the Russians are going to be firing so many nuclear warheads at us, most of the country is going to be wiped out, how do you put government back together? And I think there was a new plan devised by the government and the Cabinet Office, which I can best call the runaway plan. And what they decided to do was, rather than go out to Corsham, they decided they were going to run away in a series of small groups and hope for the best. And this plan was essentially designed to create about half a dozen different groups to focus on lots of standby prime ministers. And in the event of a movement to war, lots of junior ministers in government would have been given a letter saying, congratulations, in the event of nuclear war happening, you've been nominated as the new prime minister. And the actual prime minister would have perished in any attack on London. There was no suggestion he would have left London at the end. And instead, lots of junior ministers would have been spread out across the country with a piece of paper from the old prime minister saying, you are now potentially the new prime minister. And these groups, which are sometimes called Python groups, would have gone to a variety of locations around the country, mostly on the West Coast, mostly as far away from all the targets, so the big cities, the air bases, nuclear weapons facilities and so on. And they would have hidden away and waited for the worst things to happen and then started to come back together. Now, this was obviously incredibly secret that we had these small groups and that they were hiding. So they kept Corsham open and it was maintained as a decoy. So we hid it in plain sight that this site existed, that this bunker was there, and it was still treated as top secret. So it was still highly classified. They still had lots of information to hint at it and hide at its existence. But the secret within the secret was actually Corsham was a complete decoy. It was a white elephant and it really had no value whatsoever. And bizarrely, this is one of those very rare cases where the loss of a little bit of information about Corsham's existence was helpful because it enabled a new plan to come up which was completely hidden. And it's really telling that although Corsham first became known about in the late 1950s, it wasn't officially declassified as a top secret facility until about 2004. So it was on the top secret list for that long. The information about the Python groups, the so-called runaway plan, that stayed hidden in the depths for many years after. And it wasn't until some quite heavy Freedom of Information Act paper research was done that the plan was identified, spotted and really pulled together. And even to this day, the plan remains very sensitive and a lot of it hasn't come out. So, you know, it is really interesting about the protection of information that the existence of these sites helps hide lots of other information, and we protected the government by hiding information in plain sight. And it really was a fascinating site and a story that hasn't really properly been told very well to this day.
So how does this compare with modern security operations? What can we draw from this when it comes to our cyber security?
Absolutely. It's perhaps slightly hard at times to think, well, what on earth has the plans from a nuclear bunker from nearly 70 years ago got to do with how I keep my cybersecurity safe today? But I actually think there's an awful lot that we can think about and learn from this that relates to the sort of instance that we worry about as security professionals now, because the key principles are the same. The most important one is that information protection is key. Now, that could be in the Cold War, the location of the bunker and the plans of how we were going to get to the bunker. But today, it could be protecting the information about your business plan. It could be protecting the information about, you know, which contracts you're bidding for or what your operational plans are or all this other information that's very sensitive, where even the slightest loss of it could have a major impact on you, government planning, your commercial planning or what you want to do as a company. And it's really important that we do protect this information as best as possible because the smallest amount of it can have an impact. There's also an issue as well about what I would call accumulated data loss, and bringing bits of information together can reveal a lot more than planned. Now, in the Cold War, the things that were worried about was this inadvertent seepage of information. So, for example, when military staff visited the bunker, they weren't allowed to wear uniform for fear that they might give away the secret that there was something of interest to the military below ground. A few years later, they did aerial surveys and identified that the site was of interest because it was all laid out like a military site above ground. There was evidence of all sorts of information. These little bits of information brought together was realized was helping show that this site existed. The same is true today, though. If you think about it with social media, we can bring lots of information together about what we're up to that can actually be really sensitive. Let's say you work for a company working on a really sensitive bid that you're going for, and you don't want your competition to know that you're going out and going to have a meeting with a company you're interested in talking to, that you're bidding for a possible requirement of interest. You're trying to be as discreet as possible. You've given the project a code name and everyone's got to treat it really sensibly. But what happens if one of your staff gets on social media and says, hey, I'm flying to California today because I'm going to go and stay in a hotel for a secret project. And then what happens if their LinkedIn says they work for your company with a quite niche skill set? They've said they're going to California. And when they get to this company they're meeting, they may be check in on Facebook or suddenly say where they are. And all of a sudden, these little bits of information about what your staff are up to can be brought together very quickly, and your competition can learn where your staff are and what they're doing. The most incredible case I've ever seen was of a challenge to spot someone who was flying on a plane out on a specific plane number and where they were going to. It ended up being the case that within 8 hours of a challenge being put up on Twitter to find which nuclear scientist was on board on a BA flight, Twitter managed to identify the name of the nuclear scientist, who he worked for, where he was going, and which nuclear power plant he was visiting, all through a couple of badly judged tweets and LinkedIn images brought together for the fusion of information. So information can come together very powerfully to help give away things you really would rather people didn't know. I would definitely think about how you use and share information and whether people genuinely need to know about your work and information. The trick with Caution was it was really tightly controlled. Unless you were in some of the central planning groups and some of the tightest control committees, you didn't know what was going on there. You knew nothing about it. Even if you did know something, you might know, for example, the code name, but you'd never go to the facility. You had no idea. You knew there was a facility, but you didn't know where it was. And the more that this was brought together, the more information was controlled, the easier it was to protect it. So the lesson for us today is, how do we share our information? Do we overshare? Do we, for example, say we've had a really bad day at the office and we hate our boss? Do we moan about a project that we're working on that we don't like or we're not enjoying? What's that information going to be used for? If we work in government, for example, are we sharing images of our world that actually give information away? There was a case a few years ago of a problem in a major US government area, which was to do with sort of disaster planning, where when they put the screenshot up of the office where the problem had gone wrong, there was a little post-it note on the screen of the PC with the login name and password, which for a hacker was a fantastic opportunity to then see if they could get into the system knowing the username and password. So that's the sort of thing where you've got to think about, how do you share information? What are you doing with that information, and where is it going and who's got it? And finally, I'd say, think really carefully about whether you're sharing with information unless the person really needs to know it. Because once you've given information away, you've no longer got any control about where it goes. So during the Cold War, Caution was very tightly controlled. There was real angst in many of the papers about whether to tell people about information, whether to tell people they were nominated for going to the site, or what to tell people or allow visits. Because it was known that the moment you told someone that this bunker existed and this facility existed, you could no longer control that person. You'd add another level of risk in about the existence of the facility. And what would that person do with the information? They might keep it secret till their dying day. We still have people who worked at Bletchley Park in the 1940s who won't talk about what they did there because they took the oath, they took the Official Secrets Act so seriously. But equally, you might get someone who visits the bunker, goes down the pub and goes, "You'll never guess what I saw today." And then you get all these rumours and whispers coming out. So it's really important that if you share information, what's the person you're sharing with it going to do? And I think that applies a lot to how we treat modern data and information. The more information you share via sharing sites or emails or distribution lists, then you've lost control of it. How do you cope if that information is then out and about and beyond your control? What happens if you share a very sensitive document that goes to someone, and what are they going to do with it? How do you control where it goes? How do you control its distribution? And what's your damage mitigation plans if it's leaked? Let's say a very sensitive document about a controversial element of, say, government policy or your company's business is leaked to the media by a person you forwarded it to. What's your damage limitation plan then? How would you respond and recover from that? It's really important that we think about this information, because that really impacts on how we protect it and safeguard the secrets that we really do want to keep.
That was James Waller from the Cabinet Office. Look out for more episodes in this series. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can find out more by emailing the team at cyberconfident@mod.gov.uk.